The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. Welcome to the show. The remedy for boredom has arrived, and guess what? It's Friday.
Shit on me.
And today, I've got Smith Hart, the oldest son of Stu Hart and a founding member of the Hart family wrestling dynasty. And what a character Smith is. He's world-renowned within the wrestling business for being slightly eccentric, shall we say. He's the older brother to Brett and Owen, the uncle to Natty Neidhart. He talks about his relationship with both of his brothers, all of his brothers and sisters. Smith's got stories about the early days of Stampede Wrestling, what he remembers when his dad and mom were trying to get the promotion up and running in Calgary. You hear all the jobs that Smith and all the Hart kids had to do for Stampede Wrestling, from working the door to selling programs. You also hear what it was like growing up in the crazy Hart house with dogs and cats and more cats and more cats getting free reign. All the various wrestlers and freaks and gypsies and tramps and thieves who came to stay at his house while working in the territory. Smith tells some incredible stories, including getting his father high on marijuana, and his father didn't know it. So lots of ridiculous, incredible stories about the legendary Hart family, from the oldest child in the Hart family. Smith Hart will be here. And thanks to him for doing this, and thanks to all of my Talk is Jericho sponsors, and thanks to you for supporting those sponsors and making it possible for me to do this show for you two times a week for free, all right? And if you still haven't given DDP Yoga a try, talk about a great sponsor, one of the best sponsors we've had in the history of this show, and it works. Like I said, it's changed my life for the better. I want you to experience this as well. Check out DDP Yoga at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. You know my story. Helped me back in the ring. Still having great matches. I think at WrestleMania, the general consensus is that the three best matches were the women's match, the ladder match, and of course, Jericho versus Styles. Hey man, I'm 45. I don't feel like it. A lot of people like to harp on that. I don't. One of the reasons why I don't have to worry about it is because of DDP Yoga. It helped me to get to the top of my game, main eventing SmackDown twice and Raw once in the last 2 weeks. 3 out of 4 main events featuring Jericho, and that's because of DDP Yoga giving its influence to my mind and body. I want you to get on board, man. DDP can help you get to where you need to be physically. You want to get in better shape. DDP is going to help you do that by giving you the best price on his amazing program. Just go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. And if you buy the program, you get 3 free months of the new DDP Yoga Now app. Okay, you're going to love this app as much as I do, because it's got all the workouts on it, live workouts from the DDP Yoga Performance Center, and tons of nutrition tips, inspirational stories, videos. You can even access cooking shows so you can see how to prepare healthier meals for yourself, which will help you get into better shape. And the DDP Yoga Now app is available at iTunes and the Google Play stores. And what an incredible piece of technology this is. They did a great job. It's definitely at the top of the heap. So when you go download the app, you'll see all the amazing reviews it's getting, and you'll add your own. DDP knows how busy we all are, how crazy life can be, but now you don't have to sacrifice your workout or your health because you're too busy. You can do DDP Yoga anywhere, anytime, any place, in your house, in your apartment, in your car, probably, if you have a big enough car, maybe, like one of those hearses or something like that, or a minivan, you could probably do it in that. But thanks to the DDP Yoga Now app, you can do the program at any time as well. It's convenient. It works. You don't have to worry about DVDs, how cumbersome they are. Take advantage of the special offer DDP is giving you guys, the Sexy Beast listeners of Talk is Jericho. Order this program now at ddpyoga.com/Jericho and get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. I know some of you are sitting on the fence. Some of you are hearing this ad every week and going, enough with the DDP Yoga. Well, the only way that I'm going to convince you is if you try it. And I'm telling you, it really works. Get started today at ddpyoga.com/Jericho.
Talk is Jericho.
So we're in Calgary here, which is synonymous, if you are a wrestling fan, with the Hart family. It's the biggest, probably most legendary family in wrestling history. And I'm with Smith Hart, who is the eldest Hart child. And there was 12 of you, but you were the first.
That's correct. I am. And hi, everybody that's listening. You know, it's nice to see a good Stampede alumni, Chris Jericho, who's done us proud, done the business proud, done the WWE proud, done every federation he's worked with proud, with his unselfish loyalty and, you know, working with fans and, you know, outstanding wrestler as well.
Well, I appreciate that, man. Like I said, I'm glad we get a chance to talk today, because when you come to Calgary, it is Hart territory. And do people still take wrestling synonymous with the Harts in Calgary?
You know, they sure do all the time. Even on the way here, I walked from my place to here and ran into people that were wanting to keep me and talk wrestling. And, you know, sometimes they have a little jaded memory that they're talking about something that I know isn't quite true, but, you know, you kind of go with the flow.
So being, you know, kind of the oldest Hart kid and growing up in the family, I mean, obviously, it's probably kind of a strange environment, because Stu was the promoter and a lot of the guys would stay at his house, and there's wrestling bears and there's midgets and there's girls and there's stuff going on all over the place. What was it like kind of growing up with Stu and Helen as your parents?
Well, you know, with them as parents, we didn't know the difference, but I mean, there was no sugar in our house, let alone candy. It was honey. You know, my dad he'd buy vats of honey from the Hutterites, and we didn't go Halloweening and
No trick-or-treating?
No, too much that garbage sugar candy stuff. We all had perfect cavity. No, we had cavity-free teeth until my dad bought Clearwater Beach, and that was, you know, had a big concession there, and we were left to stay there pretty much all summer long there, and all of a sudden the dental bill started occurring, you know, and we're drinking a lot of Coke and eating a lot of O. Henry bars and stuff, and potato chips and stuff. That's bad. As far as you know, a lot of the kids in school, our show, which was originally called Mat Time, which my mother dubbed Fat Time, was on at midnight on Saturdays, so we barely ever saw it. I mean, we'd fall asleep, but we'd play so hard in the yard, just all ourselves. We had nobody else, just us, you know, growing family up to a dozen kids, finally. My mother didn't drive, and the only visitors were the milkman and people that got lost or something, and on Saturdays the wrestlers would come and get their checks, and that's the first time I'd see them, and there'd be midgets and weightlifters like Doug Hepburn, Paul Anderson, Sky High Lee, and wrestlers of every color and creed going, all coming to get their checks, Wrestling Bear included. So, but a lot of kids didn't know. We, you know, later when our show got more on like Saturday afternoon, when kids would be trying to come back on Monday trying to imitate my dad and do the holds and stuff, or even at the intermission at the pavilion here where we are now on the grounds here at Stampede, we'd be out wrestling with the guys out in the paddock right in front of the pavilion. But back in those days, it was they didn't know who we were. They'd see someone like the Mighty Ursus picking us up, and he'd be sticking his big fat arm out the window, flattening it to make it look even bigger. And my dad would show up in a limousine late to pick us up and zoom off about 90 miles an hour to get us home and back in 5 minutes. Yeah, we never ate lunch at school till we were in high school and stuff like that.
Oh, you'd always come home for lunch?
Oh, always, yeah.
Because Stu was, from what I understand, like a pretty avid family man.
He was totally avid family man. That's why there was no, you know, we didn't eat a lot of salt, a lot of pickles, a lot of stuff that has no real food value. There was no aspirins in the house, nothing, no barbiturates, no smut, no nothing like that. Very clean living house. The worst thing you could find in our house was coffee and tea.
Mm-hmm. But Stu also, he's promoting the territory, yeah, maybe even still wrestling in it.
Oh yeah, he was wrestling for a long time, always on the cards, and you know, wrestling some poor bastard for 45 minutes. You know, fill out the card. He could always do that. You know, I give some poor, didn't matter if it was Lou Cez or one of his young proteges. He'd work him for 45 minutes, and the rest of the card would have almost a night off. You know, some quick good matches, and Stu would get in with the heavy duty match, the meat and potatoes part of the feast. And you know, he'd sometimes even be the one that set up the ring in the early days, you know, just to be efficient.
Whatever had to be done, he would do it.
Yeah.
But then still come home and cook dinner and clean the house. Like, Stu was kind of running the household as well.
When possible, you know, like, if he's on the road, he's on the road. But my mother did all the public relations work, answering the phone, and it was pretty hard in those days when we first moved there. It was a party line, and we'd get someone calling from Australia at some ungodly hour of the morning, and people sometimes listening in or trying to find out what's going on. And there's really nothing in, to discuss except dates and arrivals and customs, you know, clearance and stuff. But once in a while, you're discussing minor aspects of the match or something. We finally just paid about $5,000 to have our own line put in. Every time somebody else hooked up, we were supposed to get a rebate. Well, I think we got like $5 rebate over ever.
And this is like in the 60s?
50s.
50s.
51 and
wow.
On, yeah.
So you were the first born, and who's second?
I was first born in New York, Long Beach, where my dad was wrestling for Toots Munn, which was Vince McMahon's grandfather's boss at the time. And they clicked when my dad took a furlough from Halifax with Sandor Kovacs and Al Oeming, who were aspiring wrestlers from the Navy. And it turns out that Stu and Toots had a common friend in Jack Taylor, who had, was the mentor for most of the world's champions in that era, including Frank Gotch and maybe Farmer Burns. But Jack Taylor was a monster of a guy, 6'4", with hands like shovels, and wrestling was his mistress. I don't think he ever married. And he could handle anybody. You know, he'd run 20 miles at 5 in the morning with 2 tennis balls, and he'd come back, and the tennis balls would be broken. They'd just be limp.
Wow,
like,
yeah, his grip strength.
Yeah, yeah, huge big hands,
uh-huh,
like shovels.
So what we're talking about, though, is you're the first child.
Yeah.
Who's second?
Okay, Bruce was second. I was left in Montana, in New York City, in, you know, Long Beach, the borough of Long Beach, when the police chief called my dad from Edmonton, said, "Stu, get out here and get the license. The pavilion is finished," and that was the only suitable building. They shut down a lot of projects during the war, and finally, there's a building that's suitable for wrestling.
Like a building available?
Yeah, uh-huh. Just matched the pavilion here in Calgary. So, and Larry Tillman had a monopoly here with this semi-crooked mayor named Don McKay. And when my dad applied for the wrestling license here in Calgary, they said, "No, Mr. Hart, that one promoter's enough. Two will kill each other off," which maybe is true. So, and there wasn't really any facility in Edmonton that was available or worthwhile. So my dad dropped everything, drove with my mother nonstop to Edmonton, and my mother didn't drive, but she went with him. And I was left with my grandparents, and my parents were going to pick me up a few weeks later. Well, they had a car accident in Montana before that happened. That waylaid them for 2 years. My mother broke every bone in her face. My dad broke every bone, all her teeth.
Because she was
fractured.
A beauty queen, too.
She was.
So to have her whole face.
Yeah, broke. She went right through the windshield.
Wow.
My dad broke the steering wheel of his Chrysler Imperial with his chin. Didn't do no damage to him. He died with a full set of teeth and no cavities.
So Stu never ate sugar?
No.
Ever?
No, nothing like
even
that.
Even when he was in his 80s? And
no, honey and maybe brown sugar if he had any, or he'd just soon have no sugar.
It's funny because when we got a coffee to come over here and you grabbed a bunch of packets of sugar and put it in your pocket, said Stu, because Stu would do that, right?
Yeah, exactly. A buck here, a buck there, a penny here, save, you know, it's like, you know.
Yeah, I remember one time, he would just take all the sugar in the little glass container and just put them all in his pocket.
Well, they charge you, like, in those days, like a buck for a coffee or something, or, you know, or nowadays it's like, so you can go to Starbucks and spend $6 on some Frappuccino mocha with a, you know, a caramel shot or something, you know. You're almost entitled to walk out with their cream in their honey honey jar.
Better be free.
Yeah.
So Bruce was second, and
so they were born. Bruce was born practically on the spot when they had the accident prematurely.
Well, she was pregnant.
She was very much pregnant. Okay. And then they had Keith, both Bruce and Keith, born in Montana. While I'm being raised and spoiled rotten by my mother's 4 younger sisters, she had no brothers, and my grandparents who were devoted to me because I was the son like they never had. They kept having daughter after daughter, trying to have a son to carry on the Olympic tradition. My grandfather was an Olympic track star. He broke the world record in 1912. So I have, you might say, Olympic genetics on both sides of my family. My dad being on the Canadian amateur wrestling team, Olympic team, for years. You know, in 1940 and 44 they were canceled, and he debated waiting till 48, but he had married my mother by then and had me in late 1948, and he had to support my mother somewhere.
Well, and Stu also had a really tough upbringing as well as a kid.
Yeah, he was brought up through, you know, 2 world wars and a depression.
No money.
No money.
No house.
No house, yeah. They even had a house, and they were, you know, railway out of it. Basically, it was a misunderstanding. You know, the town, the records in Trochu burned up or something, and there was also a tuberculosis outbreak or something. And anyway, they based on a late arrival, he lost his homestead, and he fought for it, and he went to jail for it, my grandfather. And his kids were taken from him for a while. And it was very sad, but in those days they were sleeping in a tent along the railway siding on their property or on the road allowance next to it. And they were just people, you know, the RCMP came along and burned all their possessions.
Record.
Yeah, because they were trespassing. It wasn't their property. Wow. Somebody else had beat them in court over it.
But this is also the Canadian prairies living in a tent. Was it winter or summer?
It was summer.
Okay.
No, I'm not kidding. It was winter. It was they had the dogs in the hot rocks at their feet and stuff. And the dogs
so they were living in a tent in the winter in the prairies?
Yeah, it's open prairie. No.
And what did they have, hot rocks?
They'd heat rocks up during the day to keep them warm during the night. And they have the dogs sleeping with them, in their...
Wow, so they'd put the rocks like at the bottom of their bed or whatever to keep them warm.
To put it in the bed, yeah.
Wow. So this guy had a tough upbringing. So as your father, was he pretty strict with you guys?
He was very strict with us, but he had the method of pulling his punches and mostly glaring at you and threatening you with he'd draw his fist back, but he would never hit you, and you're perched up by your throat against the man of freezer sticking out about 2 inches from the cupboard where you're just barely sitting on it, and if he took his hand away, you'd fall forward, and he'd be just threatening, "You ever gonna do this again?" It was mostly making a lot of noise for my mother's sake, who'd be upstairs having ratted us out, the minute he got home.
So you were kind of working in the family business as a kid?
Yeah, the first thing we ever did was sell wrestling programs. Then later I became a doorman taking tickets, and it was amazing how many people come up to me trying to slip me five bucks to get in, and we realized that the old previous gate taker, door member, just raking in money.
Right.
50 bucks in those days was a lot of money.
Is that how much a ticket was?
No, but I remember one time I got $800 on one night when we sold out, and I always would turn every penny into the more you turned in, the more praise you'd get. I wouldn't keep a penny of it.
So you got $800 in like bribes to try to get people to get in?
Yeah.
When you were a kid, did you want to be a wrestler too?
We all played at it, and we sort of liked had our heroes and stuff, like Buddy Rogers, one of my heroes for a while.
Yeah.
I more at a fairly early age realized how tedious amateur wrestling is and how boring weightlifting is. We were all in fairly good active shape just from being out on a 35-acre place out of town, with all kinds of animals and stuff, and all ourselves. We'd get up early and run hard and play hard and go to bed exhausted, and filthy dirty. We'd be running, and once in a while they'd plow the field or something, and we have dirt all over our feet. But my mother didn't care as long as we were quiet, so she could read or watch or whatever she watched on TV or catch up with. She wasn't much of a gossip. She really had nobody but her own sisters that she'd call from time to time throughout the states, mostly New York at that time. But she was a voracious reader and had to do a lot of work for my dad. Because
she took care of all the PR, all the books. Did she do the bookkeeping as well?
Everything like that.
Right. So she was kind of that was the other half of the family business was her
That's
part
right.
Of it.
Yeah. She was very devoted to that, and she could charm the pants off anybody. She could talk to a drunken, irate fan, or she could talk to the Pope charm him.
All right, we're back with Smith Hart. Now, Smith, what was the Hart family's reputation like in the city of Calgary?
Well, the family, a lot of people that thought they knew wrestling would just say it was phony. That's all he could say about it, it's phony, fake blood and this and that. And, well, it was never fake blood, but, wrestling, you can call it phony or sensible. I would call it common sense. It had to be the way it evolved. It was just the way it made sense.
But when you're walking down the streets of Calgary, are people saying, "There's the Harts"? Did they think
it was cool? Yeah, you're a cool and celebrity, basically, and you're not really a freak. Although some of the guys we had were freaks, like the French Angel or the Swedish Angel, the McGuire twins, and stuff like
that. McGuire twins were like 800 pounds or something like that.
They were 700 pounds each, and they're just an attraction, really nice guys. I think he's only one alive now, and he shrunk back. He somehow starved himself down to a respectable 200 pounds or something.
And what other freaks was it? The French Angel? Was that a giant?
Yeah, they had these guys that were normal size that had acromegaly. Yeah, and their feet would grow, and their hands would grow, and their jaw would grow, and they looked weird, but they weren't huge like Andre. They had all his features, but they were normal sized height.
Normal sized guys, yeah.
Yeah, in fact, the Swedish Angel was it the French Angel, Morris Tillett? He was quite short, actually, and he had these long gorilla arms, and he was hairy, too, and bald, and really an awful face that only a mother could love. It was like it was worse than any face you'd see in Lord of the Ring series.
So you actually did wrestle, though, right?
Well, I wrestled amateur and professional. I wrestled over a span of 18 years.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't realize you had that long of a career.
Yeah, I was not always fully active, but when I got an offer that sounded good and it was in a nice place that I hadn't seen before, I'd take it up.
So where's some of the places that you wrestled in?
I wrestled in Germany, France, Holland, Japan, all over the Caribbean, all over Canada, Montreal, Toronto, the border mountain states, Washington, Idaho, Oregon.
Were you
Montana.
Going by yourself, or was it a tag team?
I went to Puerto Rico with Brett. I went to Japan by myself. In the states, in Montana, I wrestled with all my brothers in tag situations.
So that was kind of the attraction. Here comes the Hart brothers, bring them in.
Well, yeah, we were somewhat the attractions, but also the Stomper and Abdullah and Big Daddy Ritter, which was a Junkyard Dog, And sometimes some of these guys, you couldn't get them across the border without great difficulty due to the customs, so some of these Japanese guys would really be hard to get across, whereas if you're British or Canadian or U.S., like the Big Daddy Ritter was U.S., and the Alaskan, Jay York, Mike York, they would go across without any problem whatsoever, but Jake Roberts, another one.
So did you like wrestling?
I liked wrestling, and I probably wouldn't like it if I hadn't been born into the business, but my real passion was to promote. I wanted to be a Vince McMahon, a Stu Hart, not just another wrestler at the mercy of some egomaniac booker that had a lot of ulterior motivated buddies that he's putting him over, if not himself. That's generally the case when somebody's a booker, they put their friends over or themselves over, which I would have never done. I'm very objective that way.
Over the years, when you saw Stampede kind of go through its ebb and flows, like I remember the last kind of gasp of Stampede when I was a fan in 86, 87, Bruce was the booker.
Yeah.
And then the territory kind of ended very quickly. Did you think he did a good job as a booker? So, not good?
Bruce did a much better job than Keith ever did.
Well, Keith was a booker too?
Keith and Bruce were bookers back and forth. That stems from me not bonding with either of my parents. I was bonding with my aunts and my grandparents and all the, my aunts' boyfriends. They were mostly service guys even after the war, and the Korean War was still going on. Bruce was my mother's pet right away. Years later, Brett usurped that position on Bruce, and Keith was my dad's pet. And Keith was a fairly aggressive little shit that I used to pound pretty good, I know them all. I know who is really good, and I know who are less than good,
right?
From my experience. And Ross is a saint. Ross is one of the best brothers you can have. Owen was a saint. Owen was as good as you could get. Brett's all right, but Keith mentored Brett a bit, I never really got along with Keith for some reason. I don't know if he knows it or not. Keith's done me a few good turns, and he's done some less than good things with me and through me, but same to my father too. I think he took advantage of my dad many a time, but Butsy, as we call him, or Bug Eyes was his original nickname. He's got kind of a greedy streak in him. He's very monetary-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'm here to bury him or anything. I love all my brothers and sisters.
Well, how about your brother Dean? That's kind of the forgotten
Dean was
heart,
a great... I'm glad you brought that up, Chris, if anything. Dean passed
away a long time ago. So I just want to set the tone so people know who Dean is. Dean is Smith's brother who died.
Dean was my favorite brother. He was the toughest of all of us, even though he was the smallest. He, pound for pound, he was like a little weasel or like Johnny Devine, the honey badger. Mm-hmm. But Dean was a tough, vicious little guy, and I don't think he had a small man's complex, but he wasn't that big, but he was certainly a handsome guy, and he was my Dean had a lot of nerve when it came to anything, whether it was a fight one-on-one or even several guys on one. He didn't back down, and he unfortunately died of kidney complications when he got hit by a city bus here in Calgary and bounced him pretty good. And he was, because they tested the protein in his urine, they said, something's wrong here. Your kidneys aren't working well. It turns out that was a result of the traffic, the highway, you know, getting hit by the C train or the bus.
So basically had kidney failure. That's what he passed away from.
Yeah, ruptured his kidneys. Yeah, and he wasn't honoring the system, the dialysis regimen. He hated that. He said, "I feel terrible when I go in. I feel awful while it's happening, and I feel awful after it's happened." You know.
How old was he when he passed away?
35.
Wow, and that was 19.
Like almost same age as Owen. Yeah, I don't know what year that was. It was in November. Yeah. I found him as good as dead, lying there with the bathtub just about ready to overflow. He was getting ready to have a bath. This girl named Janine, I think it was Rogers or something. She was Autry, Janine. Yeah, I was thinking Roy Rogers.
Jean Autry.
Yeah, she was practically a doctor. Her husband was, and she was some kind of nurse. And the first time she came to Calgary, a big fan of Brett's, she stayed at my parents' house, and she got to charm my mother over the years before she came, but. She looked at Dean and said, "You're in trouble," you know, and she got him back on the regimen, and then he slipped off again, and she'd heard about it, and she's making a special trip, but I don't think she ever made it because he died before that. Mm-hmm. But he was, in lieu of her coming, in view of her coming, he decided to clean up his act, and he was getting ready to go to the dialysis for the first time in weeks.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
He just wouldn't go. He'd just say, "I hate it so much, I don't want to go," and he'd stay. But he fainted that day, and we couldn't seem to revive him.
You're trying to get him artificial respiration?
Yes. You know, wow. Yeah. And my dad's back and forth between us from on the phone in the office to the bedroom, to the bathroom where Dean was lying there. And the fire truck or the paramedic truck went by several times, couldn't seem to find the house for some reason. We thought they'd all know where we lived, but there was a new fire hall up there that wasn't, it wasn't the usual one, and you know, they went by one way and then another way, and then finally they pulled in, but I don't know if it would have made any difference. But anyway, Dean was pronounced dead on arrival.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that you always wanted to be a promoter, and Dean and you were promoters when you talked about Clearwater Beach. You guys promoted.
Dean promoted all kinds of stuff. You know, he had attended some of the Three Dog Night concerts here in Calgary, which a guy named Brian Ordesky, who was kind of Dean's friend, he had promoted them very successfully. And Floyd Sneed, a black drummer, was from Calgary here, was a big wrestling fan, used to sell the Body Press program, and he was in the band. And Dean ran quite a few. He brought in the Doors. This was after Jim Morrison died, but he brought them to Edmonton.
When they were playing without Morrison?
Yeah, he brought in Nazareth and Chilliwack many times, and different ones. I can't remember all of them. Even Charlie Ritchie brought to the McMahon Stadium.
Hmm. Were you involved in the promotion of that too?
A little bit. I'd make his posters. I made his posters for Dr. Hook. I showed them to Ray Sawyer. Dr. Hook, hey, that's pretty good. I'm going to keep this one. That's really good for a hand-drawn poster. You know.
Was it the Beach Boys too? Did he do some of the Beach Boys? Or did you do some of the Beach Boys?
I knew the Beach Boys, and my wife knew Love. What's his name?
Mike Love.
Mike Love, yeah, quite intimately. And she traveled with them a little bit here and there.
Did you ever hang out with them?
No, but she did, and they were. I think they did come to Puerto Rico. She kind of set that up with them, and she was kind of mad that they had a song about Kokomo, but they couldn't seem to put it in Puerto Rico in the rhyming and all that, but I don't know if they wrote it or somebody else did. But
okay. Yeah. Well, you know, you mentioning Owen earlier, too. How much of a difference in age was there between you and Owen?
14 years, maybe, at the most.
So those 12 children in 14 years.
Yeah, something like that. My mother even miscarried at one point.
Really?
Yeah, so she would have, and she wanted to have 15 kids.
15?
Doctors, Owen and Diana were never supposed to be. The doctor said, after Ross was born, that's it, you know, you're cut off.
She's
getting too weak. You can't, you know, you could die or the kid could die. And she managed to get two more out. And then he said, that's it, no more. You're asking for trouble, you know, mm-hmm. playing with fate. So she reluctantly had her tubes tied or whatever they do.
Okay, so that was after Owen and Diana came. So did you have a relationship with Owen?
Yeah, I did. I liked Owen. Owen and I had, Owen was everybody's little buddy and pet, you know, mm-hmm. like some of these books have said, they dress him up and stuff. Well, the girls would dress him up like their way for, you know, but that wasn't like when he went to school. But we'd get him, we'd grease his hair back and get him a custom-made little black leather jacket and stuff, and, you know, whatever the was in fashion for the high school kids and even junior high kids, he'd be wearing in grade 1 and 2 and 3, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was kind of like, you were the mascot. Older brother, and the mascot, yeah.
Yeah.
What'd you think of him as a wrestler?
A fantastic wrestler. Yeah. Like, as I was telling one of the guys when I was waiting for you, Chris, I said, when Jay Paul came to do the Wrestling with Shadows, he said, well, when you think of the best there is, the best there was, the best there ever will be, what do you think? I said, well, certainly not Brett. And I was a little bit pissed off at Brett over a court deal at that time, but I said, I think of Owen when I think of that. Mm. And he didn't want to talk to me anymore. And then he sees Bruce, you know, we're all supposed to be there for this, to contribute to this movie documentary. And Bruce said something about Brett's head is so big he couldn't get in the door, and we had pretty big doors in that house. Then Ellie, you know, he says, your brother Brett, and she says, that effing bastard, I tried to run him over yesterday, and if I see him today, I'll succeed and all that. And Jay Paul thought, I'm in the wrong house here. This is, you know.
Yeah.
And even Wayne said something about no comment or something, and he was like, he didn't know what to do, you know, he's no one else to turn to. And then my mother came down, you know, my dad was helping her get ready and all that, and she turned on the charm about how wonderful Brett was and, you know, how much he's done for the family. So, you know, like when my mother never wanted to discuss wrestling with her sisters when considering that their father was an Olympic runner, and wrestling is very far removed any way you look at it from Olympic track and field. But once Brett was wrestling and was basically an established star, my nieces and my cousins, I should say, you know, female and male, all over the States. A lot of my aunts had like 10 kids or more, like my mother. They'd want to meet Liberace and Cyndi Lauper and Little Richard and all that. And they'd want tickets to go backstage and see Andre the Giant and whoever. So my aunts would be, can you get us tickets? And my mother, through Brett, would pull all the strings, you know, and they'd get all kinds of backstage access and mm-hmm. VIP treatment. So that's like when Brett kind of took over Bruce's position as one of my mother's as key the pets. Yeah.
I imagine, though, too, when you have 12 children, that it's hard for everybody to get along.
Yeah, like Wayne definitely was the black sheep of the family, and it still affects him. He's fairly sour and bitter, and maybe has some reason to be. But like, I remember when it was like I'd come up with some criminal scam, like, you know, the neighbors are gone, and let's see what's interesting in there, and maybe take some booze or some.
I'll go in their house.
Silverware. Oh yeah. And we didn't have too many neighbors. It'd be pretty obvious who did what or something, you know. But Bruce and Wayne and Dean would do the dirty work, you know, in some cases, because they were underage, even though I was too. But, I mean, the minute Bruce and Keith couldn't wait to see my dad's car coming, I'd say, now I know there's going to be another beating for me, because they're going to rat immediately. It didn't matter what I'd done or if I'd even done it. My dad would be backhanding me, you know, and grabbing me by the hair and, you know, demanding the truth or what, you know, and Dean and Wayne would pull off some little stunt, and then Bruce and Keith would rat, and then would all be, you know, they'd be punished. But my dad would, my mother would say, Stu, don't hit him in the face, or, you know, like, with Dean at least, you know, and with Wayne, nobody said anything, you know, and Wayne would get most of the mauling. And I don't know why that was, really. But it's just too bad, you know. I don't want to paint a horrible picture. If some of my aunts heard this, they'd be thinking, oh, what a liar I am, or what, you know, but most of it was bluff and, you know.
You have the reputation of being kind of an eccentric guy.
I am somewhat eccentric, you know. I go by what seems to make sense, you know, mm-hmm. at the time. And so I like shortcuts, even if they're uphill, let's say. And mm-hmm. I sometimes regret the shortcuts I've taken, because they never end. Kind of, you say, why did I even start this? I thought it was, I'd be here by now, and here I'm like 3 days behind. Like, whenever I wrestled, Bruce would job me out to anybody. There would be a guy who was an usher the night before, and Bruce having me lose to him and stuff.
Why is that?
I don't know why. It may keep me down, keep me from getting, you know, rising up and being a threat to him. I don't know why. That's about the only reason I can think of, because it didn't make sense. You know, the fans didn't buy it, didn't believe it, you know. And I didn't even really want to wrestle for the most part, like, because I didn't like weightlifting. And you have to look the part, really, even though Bruce didn't. And You know, Keith worked out really hard, but he wasn't neither Bruce nor Keith are really big guys, you know.
Yeah, genetically, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they're like 5'9" each, but and I'm only 5'10", but that's, you know, back in those days, that was an average-sized wrestler, 5'10", like my dad. And, you know, I was able to drive Cadillac cars all my life and live in a mansion and eat like a king and stuff, but I didn't have a lot of money in my pocket. You know, I'd be cashing in the bottles after a party that would normally be thrown out. Or, you know, like my dad's not kind of bothered. It's beneath his dignity if the hired help didn't grab all the bottles after a party or something. I would, you know, and that'd keep me in. You know,
give me some change.
Give me some
pocket.
Change, yeah.
How about when the story of when you picked up some a dead pheasant on the roadside?
Well, yeah, it wasn't dead. The guy I was driving with was somewhat drunk, and I said, "Peter, get off. You're in the shoulder. You're going to hit that pheasant." It was just taking flight, a big cock pheasant. And he splattered it, and he said, "I didn't hit it, did I?" I said, "No, that was a mosquito. There's enough blood on the windshield to cover the whole passenger side, and the bird's flopping around behind us." He says, "What should we do? Should we get it?" I said, "Yeah." And it was right there still. I was afraid a semi would hit it and squish it and be kind of good for nothing. But anyway, just because it was freshly killed, and, you know, I didn't have to go hunt it or anything, and you know, you don't even see pheasant for sale in the grocery stores. So I cooked it lovingly for my dad, who was not at least bit opposed to eating a wild game. And my sisters had seen me bring it in the night before, and they, "Well, what are you going to do with that?" And I said, "I'm going to pluck it. I'm going to soak it and do whatever, you know." So when I cooked it in this orange sauce, and I had a recipe that I followed, and I made my dad a whole meal, and I just took him up a little taste. I said, "You like this?" He says, "Yeah, it's good." He said, "I think it's a little overdone." But I said, "Yeah, it is." So I went down to get the rest of it. My sister Georgia or Ellie, I can't remember, maybe both, had in disgust thrown it to the lousy little Cocker Spaniels who used to defecate all over the house and always do it away from my dad's room. And my dad said, "You never do it in my room. I can't believe it. You know, they're such good little dogs." Well, they were bad little dogs. But anyway, I see the dog eating it all. She wolfed the whole thing down. She's a real pig, this little Molly that Jim Neidhart had got from some mafioso guy. And once he realized that she wasn't too house-trained, he dumped her on my dad. But anyway, the one dog wolfed it all down. There was nothing left but a couple of slices of orange. But unfortunately, I'd given Matthew a taste of it, my son, and myself, and Tanya, my daughter, and my dad. But the rest of the outside, of the little taste of it off the breast, the dog wolfed the whole thing down, bones and all.
So your Sunday dinner was destroyed.
Yeah, it was destroyed. No, you know, there was that wasn't even necessarily a Sunday, but that was just something for my dad. But it was like people would compete to, you know, curry my dad's favor. Like my sister Georgia would be up in Spolumbo's, the place has it's pretty good Italian deli from a couple of local football players that teamed up, and she'd come over with stuff, and whatever I had just served my dad, that would be whisked away, and all of a sudden what she'd brought would be what my dad's eating, and usually the Cocker Spaniel got what I had worked on, you know, just wolfing it down like a little pig, even though she's already stuffed to the guts. You know, she never left my dad's side, basically, which is good.
Because your dad had a lot of animals in the house, too, a lot of cats.
We had a lot of cats. He loved cats, and my mother liked cats, too. Both my parents liked dogs and cats a lot, you know.
They kind of roam free throughout the house, though,
all over
the place,
I mean,
right?
They did, sharpening their claws on anything. It didn't matter if it was made out of rawhide. They'd sharpen their claws on it, and the Persian carpets, too, you know. And then they'd piss on them, too, when they're at will. So that's too bad, but you can hardly keep track of it. I mean, there's like sometimes as many as a dozen cats.
A dozen cats.
Yeah.
Would you just take them in off the street or something?
People would dump them off there sometimes. Like I remember one guy who had done some lousy brick job for my dad, and it was a big letdown for my dad how it turned out, and the quality of bricks he used, they didn't match. He said he could match the ones we had and stuff. But he came down to get one of his last payments, and all of a sudden, I see a car just leaving slowly, guiltily, and all of a sudden, this big white Tomcat appears, and he went over and he pissed on all four tires of this guy's Volkswagen van that was wanting more money from my dad for his rotten brick job. And my dad picked the cat up and just examined him, and yeah, he's a Tomcat, ready to go. I don't think we had any females that were breedable at that time, but the cat was ravenous. It was hungry as hell and went in the house, and my dad picked him up and says, "The guy's hungry." My mother liked him right away and named him Bojangles.
Did you? You told me earlier about when you helped your mother out when she was asking you some advice about marijuana.
She was, she was getting. She drank because she was depressed a lot. Sometimes business wasn't good, you know, and wrestling can be up and down.
Depends. Very cyclical, right?
Oh, well, very much so. And when we lost our TV, we were almost out of business. We were, you know, talking to people about not just mortgaging the house but selling it outright, and at a horrible price. Well, this was a little after that, but my mother, in all her innocence, asked me, geez, I'm gaining a lot of weight and stuff, and I used to buy her booze once in a while. Like, she'd give me, that was another source of money, she'd give me $20 and ask for a big bottle of Danini or something, some of these cheap wines that, you know, they come in huge bottles. Like, I remember at Clearwater Beach one time, the Croatians were having a barbecue picnic, and they had a goat on a spit or something, and they're drinking the scams of wine, and Andre the Giant was invited out, and he spoke Yugoslavian. That was his
really,
you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was French Yugoslavian, Rusimov or whatever. And he, so he's got a bottle of this wine. It's like a beer bottle in his hand. He's got a whole leg of lamb, and it's like a drumstick. That's apropos of a guy his size, you know. It's like, but anyway, she'd give me, you know, it cost $12. I'd keep the change. It was all a fair deal, you know. And my dad used to wonder where, okay, he knew he'd bought some of the wine, but he thought there's a lot of bottles out there for considering what he just sort of thought, you know, he couldn't get, you know, nobody ever thought I was buying it for her. But she'd get depressed and she'd drink, so she was gaining weight, and she said something about marijuana, and she'd read something about it. And I said, no problem, I got some right here. As a matter of fact, I got a joint ready to go or something. And we didn't know Georgia had just arrived, probably with more goodies from Spolumbo's. But anyway, she had never smoked a cigarette in her life and didn't know how, just like I didn't. So I lit it up for her, and she took a puff and didn't do it right, and she coughed and all that. And that's when Georgia walked in and says, "You're not toking Mom up, are you?" And I said, "Absolutely not, Georgia. What are you talking about?" And she says, "I smell something." And she did. She, you know, now she knows, because I denied it always, but now the truth is out.
So. But Helen never got high.
She never wanted to do it after that. She was just, you know, Georgia ruined all the highs she could have had after that. Maybe she might still be alive. I don't know.
But did you ever give Stu any?
As a matter of fact, I'm surprised you would ask that. One day I had somebody give me, a biker girl, give me a handful of magic mushrooms. These are blue mushrooms from Mexico. And I hadn't tried them yet, but Stu saw them in my hand. He saw, "You got some mushrooms there." And he grabbed me, wolfed down a couple of big ones. And before the night was over, I was supposed to take the cage. We had a cage match that night in Calgary, and we were supposed to have another one in Edmonton the next day. And it was an afternoon show. And anyway, I left as soon as we finished the match with the cage. I took it away right away. I was avoiding my dad. His face was red and shiny, and he had a grin on that he couldn't seem to.
To shake,
yeah. And I don't know if he realized what happened. To this day, I never heard, but. I remember I got to Edmonton, and I didn't wake up till about an hour after the wrestling had already started, and they were in a real panic about where's the cage. It's nowhere to be seen, and there was no cell phones in those days. Nobody knew where I was. They didn't know I was leaving that night. I just wanted to get out of sight, out of Dodge, in case my dad put two and two together about the mushrooms. But I hope he wasn't too embarrassed over it, but I didn't see much of it. I left, and as I got the sign, that, you know, that I saw his face so red, and he had a grin on that wouldn't quit.
You mentioned Andre earlier. Did you hang out with him a bit or at all? Or
a little bit, you know. Mm. When he came to Puerto Rico, I'd hang out with him. But he was kind of a guy that didn't like a lot of company. He didn't mind the odd female company and stuff. And he was a pretty sociable guy, but. And one particular day, he had told my dad that his visa was going to expire during the 10 days that he was in Calgary. And part of those, in that 10-day period, were some bookings in Montana. So when his visa, if he stayed in Canada, it would be fine. When he went back to New York, it would all be redone for him by McMahon's, you know, Vince McMahon's father, who had him under contract then. But Andre had a, you know, kind of a girlfriend here, Babette Bardot, with a 52-inch bust and all that, and reputed cousin, distant cousin of Bridget Bardot. But anyway, she legitimately had the big bust, you know, no.
Wow, 52 inches.
Yeah, nothing fake about it either. It was right. Pretty well proportioned. And she was somewhat of an exotic dancer and gymnast, and her husband did a little skit on stage with her, and they got to where they'd show up Stampede Week and be booked here and there at different hotels, and we often used Andre in Stampede Week, even in matches with the world's champion, like Harley Race one time. But he invited her into the ring in the parade, in the float that we pull an actual wrestling ring through the Stampede route. And we'd have a couple other convertibles for the world's champion or sometimes for lady wrestling stars. And Andre was just sitting down with Babette to have steak and lobster at the Calgary Inn, probably the best hotel in the city. And I come in with the bad news. You got to go to Montana right now. And he was furious. Yes, he had to pass up the meal and the date, And
anyway, to go get his visa.
To go to Montana and then be stuck at the border and not be able to cross back into Canada for the big shows. But anyway, somehow my dad got a hold of Vince over the weekend, and they pulled the strings in Washington or wherever, got him a visa, and he's able to come back in and finish the bookings in Calgary. But because we were so late, by the time Andre, he dragged his big ass as long as he could, it was like pretty much a foregone conclusion that we're not going to make that flight, but he didn't know how I drove. And I was in a one-way alley, and I'm going to resume right past the police station in my process and run a couple of lights. And I ran every light I could run. I didn't care. And there was some old retired guy who was, late, almost ready to drop dead. This cop calling me, he's an old retired guy in the 60s, and he couldn't keep up, and he had an old gutless car. He wasn't an interceptor or anything. But when I came back from getting Andre through customs and all that, and I come back in, there he is with Brett, ready to haul me into jail. And when I explained everything, I gave him a pretty long, rounded, account of what had happened. Never mind, forget it. Say hi to Stu.
Say hi to Stu. Because that's the thing, like you said, you were a Hart, and everybody in Calgary knows the Harts and knows what's going on. Did mention the losing TV, which was a huge deal at the time. Yeah. What happened to get kicked off of TV?
Well, to start with, Mike DiBiase, who is like the stepfather of Ted DiBiase, he was in here with Bulldog Pletches, and they used to have a show that was in just before the news would come on, with Ed Whalen, our commentator, and he would play the role of a soda jerk, and the wrestler would come in and usually have a shill sitting there having a coffee that was one of the someone worked at the studio. And the wrestler would come in, and Ed would have some lines for him, like, oh, so who are you wrestling tonight, or what's going on here, you're this and that, or you're... Anyway, DiBiase went in and said that if... brains were money and it cost 5 cents to go around the world. The average Canadian couldn't cross the street, and furthermore, the women are dowdy, and he's disgusted by this and that. Well, I don't have to take that. I'm a proud Canadian. He pulled the plug, and the show went dark and was just...
For real?
For real. He went nuts, and so we lost that show. But years later, we had our Mat Time show still on.
But let me just interject here. Ed Whalen, who was the announcer, but he had a lot of power as far as being able to pull the plug on Stampede Wrestling. You had to go along with that?
Well, at that time, there was no other studio. That was it. There was no competition. CTB hadn't come yet. In fact, that's who we went with after that. Well, what happened was an architect, Pat Sullivan, who lived in that area, realized that there was bylaws that were signed so that the studio wouldn't have any activity after certain hours, and anything that disturbed the residents would be subject to scrutiny and this and that. So he took it upon himself, and it took him about 18 months to get like 15 signatures saying that they were bothered by the noise at night after midnight and people coming and going, and that they shut us right down. They said we have no choice. So then they left us the option of producing the show away from the studio at the Pavilion again, which we had to pay the full rent for, but they had to, in order to have it ready by midnight, they couldn't do it any later than 10 o'clock in the morning. So from 10 to 11, we'd have the show done. And the fans had just seen all the blood and guts the night before live. Now they see kind of a watered down show with short little matches to fit in this time slot. And I don't even know if it was a full hour. It might have only been a half hour show, but I think it was an hour. anyway, just that vacuous building with only like 50 people sitting mm-hmm. there spread out, and they didn't want to all sit in the ringside. Some of them didn't like the lights shining in their face, and they'd sit up high and they could drink and stuff and whatever. It just was a bad atmosphere to the point where we were losing money. That's when my dad almost had to sell the house cheap, okay. You know, like for less money than he paid for it, and he got it for a hell of a deal. I mean, mm-hmm. It was a hard sell. It's too big a house for most people to pay the utilities. Our utilities amounted to $1,500 a month many times.
Just because of the size of it and all the people living in it.
Yeah, exactly.
So you lost the TV the first time with DiBiase. The second time?
Second time we lost the whole big show. This little five-minute excerpt that we did before the news on Friday night, just before the wrestling, it was a good little show, but that was one thing we lost. Then we lost the actual show, and then we had to do it at the pavilion, and it just was never the same quality.
Right.
And when they built the studio right next to my dad's house, CTV, Menaker was interested in coming back in, and he was a phenomenal guy. He used to be Gorgeous George's manager, and he was married to June Byers, the world's champion. He'd been in, he was a friend of Blackstone, the magician. He could do a lot of magic tricks himself. I see the ones that David Blaine was doing in the street. Mm-hmm. He was doing them in the 50s, same ones.
That's one thing, like, you know, Tom, you know, we were in the wrestling business for years. We know all the tricks, but magic, it frustrates me that they really don't tell their tricks. I don't know any of them, and it really pisses me off because I want to know.
Some that are done by mathematics. I've learned a few with cards and stuff, but I'm not into that, really. I'm not into gambling. We had a pool table for 40 years, a professional 12-foot pool table in my dad's house. I never played one game on it. Didn't care.
So, but over the years of Stampede Wrestling, you're talking about kind of some of the ups and downs, but as far as the performers, who were some of the absolute greats that you saw?
Some of the absolute greats were the Stomper.
Archie the Stomper is pretty underrated, I think. If you're from Calgary, or you know him, but a lot of people don't.
There was never a guy that could do as intense an interview, a heel interview, as Archie Goldie. I know some of his tricks he practiced over and over with a tape recorder in front of a mirror, but which I never knew. But Keith took it upon himself to visit him and stay over one weekend in Carbon, where Archie lived. And but Archie would have the most intense, believable interviews I've ever heard. Like, they would scare people. Abdullah didn't do interviews because he had the role of an insane, crazy guy that couldn't speak any English, But he had... The most money we ever made was with Abdullah the Butcher. He was my dad's basically favorite heel, but the Stomper would be right there, second, close second. Dr. Jerry Graham was another one, a prolific villain, bleeder, and pretty good talker. Disgusting villain. The fatter he got, the more hated he was, and he'd still be doing the Buddy Rogers strut and stuff.
I believe that I heard as a teenager that was Vince's favorite wrestler, Vince McMahon Jr., that he loved Jerry Graham.
Yeah, I loved Jerry Graham, too. And Leo Burke, who was a pretty credible wrestler, he thought that Jerry Graham was maybe as good as there was, for all around. And Jerry Graham had small hands, much bigger than my mother's, and like I think about size 8.5 feet or something. But he had the big high ass going up to his shoulder blades, and he'd be doing the strut and the dirty black-rooted greasy hair, It was like the pre-mullet days, but he was good, he brought in his own crew of guys. He'd be working with like Chief Big Heart and Louis Hernandez and stuff, guys he'd worked with before, and mm-hmm. he brought in Crazy Luke Graham, and never brought his real brother, Eddie Graham never came in. He was already too busy promoting Florida by then. Jerry was kind of on the decline, but still had lots of drawing power. Mm. Waldo Von Erich is one of the best villains of all time. Prince Von Erich was a pretty credible villain, big raw recruit when we had him. Gene Kaniski and Killer Kowalski are two top villains.
What about when you started bringing in guys from England, like Dynamite? What did you think of him?
Dynamite Kid was phenomenal with his moves, but he didn't weigh probably more than 165 pounds when he first came, but he was very curious about steroids and stuff, and he bumped himself up rapidly, and he never stopped. Basically, when he went into the WWE and the steroids were not only abundant but legal and very readily available, maybe even free, he got huge.
Massive, Very muscle bound.
Some of the best villains of all time that were ever hit Calgary, even in the pre-TV days, were Al Mills, first of all, and then Jim Wright. And those two wrestled in India for about 75,000 people for some war effort to raise money for India. And Nehru gave them each some kind of gemstone ring or something. And valuable rings, and I think they donated their service. I don't think they even got paid, but they got these nice rings. And I remember, Jim Wright was a legitimate tough guy. Rube Wright and Jim Wright were two big guys from Arizona that nobody screwed with. You know, they could handle themselves very well. They're pretty good amateur wrestlers. Like another one was Wilbur Need, but Al Mills wasn't that much of a submission wrestler, Olympic kind of wrestler, but just a tough guy and no fear of the fans whatsoever. He'd be out in Indian Reserve, and the Indians are like ready to kill him because he'd just beaten Chief Thunderbird, who was a real Squamish Indian chief, to a bloody pulp somewhere. And the promoter, with Al Oeming, in this case, my dad's partner, my dad couldn't wrestle and promote in Edmonton at the same time. He had a real bunch of assholes for the commission out there. Yeah, a real bunch of thieving bloodsuckers. But anyway, he told me a story not long before he died about Al Mills, and he was telling me a lot of the stuff about the aforementioned Jack Taylor. But Mills was in the ring, and Al said something about, do you want me to call the police? Like, they won't get here for 45 minutes. And Al said, no, just let them simmer for a minute. You know, like, and he finally, nobody really left the building. Indians are still ready to kill him. And they got to do him. If any one of them had started to get in the ring, I guess Al would have had to, knock him cold or something. But nobody ever left. They're still there milling around, ready to kill him. And he just said hell with it. He jumped down and just walked right through them like they weren't there. And they parted for him. Nobody struck him or anything. And I've seen Abdullah do the same thing in Japan, where there's like 10,000 people ready to slit rip him apart. And he just walks. But, I remember Angus Campbell was trying to fill Abdullah's shoes here, and he had a near riot. You know, he gave him the kind of same scenario as Abdullah, where he mauled two guys at once. You know, and when he jumped out of the ring, I'm following him as the referee, ready to kind of clear a path for him and say, not going to hit me, I've done nothing. But behind my back, he grabs two chairs and he's trying to swing. All of a sudden, chairs and crutches and bottles start flying. He should have not touched the chairs.
Yeah.
Just follow me.
Right. So that you were a referee too.
Yeah, I refereed. I did everything. Drove, set rings up, promoted.
Everything had to be done.
Quite often, Bob Johnson, bless his heart, he would tell my mother, I just couldn't get a spot show for Edmonton, which is one of our big dates. If you lose Edmonton, the gate of Edmonton, you're losing almost half your between Calgary and Edmonton. That's what, all these other towns were just insignificant. And I'd say, I'll get a town, and I'd whip something together. I'd go to one of the Indian reserves where I had friends and stuff, and I'd get a building for $50 or something. I'd say, we got a show here, and I'd poster it, and we'd make something and be enough to maybe pay Bad News Allen's salary for the week, which helped. I never got a penny out of it. I didn't ask for a penny. I was always trying to prove myself, which I did over and over and over. A lot of the best ideas and angles that ever came about were my ideas that Bruce would project. Keith wouldn't even push them.
Do you remember any of the angles that you're talking about?
Well, one was I wanted to have Marty Jones wear a mask for something, and when I was explaining it to either Bruce or Keith, they said, yeah, and then when you unmask him, I said, no, you don't unmask him. I said, leave it if they know who it is. You don't unmask him that night. You wait for a while. It was something to do with a cage match, and Keith says, yeah, well, we got to have blood, and I said, you can't bleed with a mask on. I said, well, not necessarily. You probably could if you wanted, but that's beside the point. Keith couldn't understand it. Bruce would usually buy the idea, but put his own touch on it so that I couldn't get credit for it.
Just take it, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think was the reason that Stampede finally closed in 1989 after being around for 40-odd years?
Well, to be honest with you, my dad was losing 100,000 a year, so when Vince Sr. approached my parents with this little proposition to be presented in Tokyo, Japan, at his expense, my parents were like, it was like relief coming. It's like they can immediately save 100,000 a year, plus he was going to give them $500,000 up front and plus 5% of the gross gates forever in our towns. But he wanted our TV slot, and he wanted, the you know, us to pave the way for him to meet the media and the, you know, and the building people and do it, you know, just take over our.
This is senior or junior?
Senior.
Okay.
We didn't last too much longer after that. He died. But then Vince Jr. didn't honor the original commitment, and apparently he was expanding at such a rate that he was spending more, you know, had a cash flow problem. So, that, you know, when they say he bought us out, nobody bought us out. We capitulated. But, you know, my dad was making, he was subsidizing the wrestling with the sale of our property in front of the house. You know, United Management, our neighbors, the Singer family had bought the property by default through somebody else that had bought it. And Last Mountain Resorts bought it, and they went defunct, and Singers picked it up. But when interest was 21%, Singers were paying a whopping 17.5% compounded monthly to my parents. And that's what subsidized Bruce and Keith back and forth. Sometimes Keith would make a play when my mother was on an extended visit seeing her sisters in the States, and she'd come back and Bruce would be crying the blues that he'd been screwed out of his position, and Keith and the Japanese boys had taken over, and before long Bruce would be back in position and Keith be on the outs. And,
you just know, playing your mom, huh?
Yeah, basically. Right. And you know, when Keith started his own little thing, my dad had way too many wrestlers, and Keith said, "No, keep them all. I'm gonna, you know, take over. I'm gonna run a separate show in the interior of BC." And Keith claimed for income tax reasons he had to have a numbered company and this and that. And all of a sudden, it's none of them. I don't know if my dad ever got a penny out of it, but when it's all over, Keith said, "Well, at least I took half the wrestlers off your payroll, you know, off your back, you know." And a lot of them would have gone to the Maritimes, but you know, it's a summer territory, as opposed to most territories that draw best in the winter. And anyway, it was a back and forth thing. I never got in on it. I'd promote these spot shows and even do concessions and everything, and be selling coffee and donuts and stuff and popcorn and whatever. Those you can make popcorn lights with it. They think it's home popped. It's all bagged weeks before. But you know, I'd come home with thousands of dollars from these shows. And barely get a thank you or any acknowledgement, and certainly no position for it, or you know,
no credit,
no placement, nothing. You know.
So you're saying it's basically a financial reason though why Stampede finally ended, and that was it.
Yeah, it was like a relief to have someone when you're wondering. You know, if it wasn't for the United Management land money coming in, see, they didn't want to pay outright because they were in a cash flow problem themselves. Trudeau had screwed the entire economy, the economy in Canada, in Western Canada, with his lapse of oil incentives, the exploration incentives, but you know, we were struggling along, and I'm always saying, "Let me do it. I'll make money for you." You know, like, it was very, very inefficiently run. The vans were always late, and they'd have to be had the hell driven out of them, you know, and overloaded. Where, you know, like some van left early because they wouldn't wait for everybody, and then when everybody shows up, they all got a pile in one van or something. And you know, I would maintain the vans very well. I was the first one that suggested vans. We used to just drive in cars, you know, and the wrestlers would basically drive themselves, but they, you know, whoever drove would get extra trans money, which they deserved. You could put more than double two carloads in these big maxi vans. You know, they'd hold 15 normal people. We could probably put 10 wrestlers in quite easily, which is more than two carloads. So, and they'd run about the same as a Cadillac gas wise. But I had a lot of ideas that were mine. The world mid heavyweight championship for Dynamite Kid was my idea and my belt. You know, it's sitting in Brett's trophy cabinet. I bought it. I paid for it, leather and casting and everything, all at my own expense. And it's, you know, my dad gave it to Brett. Mm. Brett was furious one day when Kevin, the houseboy, handed it to me because Gamma Singh wanted to borrow it for India, and he told me, "I'll have it double gold plated for you if I can use it." And I said, "Sure." I went over and said, "Kevin, can you get me that belt?" No problem. He knew exactly where it was amidst all of Brett's other belts. And, you know, the W belts, they make, you know, they give you one every time you win the title. You know, they don't pass the one single belt around like they did in the NWA. But that was a solid gold belt, all those NWA ones. In fact, the last one they made was supposed to be worth $20,000 because it was they had a deficit in money, and they're supposed to be, profit-free organization, you know, the NWA. So, and they knew the price of gold was going up imminently, so they went to Mexico where they could get cheap goldsmithing, and they had a fairly lousy belt made up. It was heavy and worth a lot of money, but it was not. It was a lopsided belt, but, you know, wasn't balanced at all like the previous belt, which was a lot lighter. It was real gold, but it was pounded out. This was solid gold, like thick, heavy. It was like Harley Race gave it to me, and he said something about, you're holding $50,000, kid, plus my Rolex and my ring or something. And don't take your eyes off it. But, you know, it was a heavy, big, ugly, unbalanced
belt. It was worth
belt.
A lot of money, yeah.
Yeah, and it disappeared, like the other belt. I don't know who's got it. I mean, I hope one of the punks maybe has it, because I admired them as good good for the business.
So do you miss, you know, you talked about Dean and Owen and Stu and Helen. Do you miss, I mean, obviously you miss them, but do you, like, you talk very fondly of your father. Do you miss having them around?
Oh, absolutely. My dad was all common sense, and he never got ruffled. You know, I noticed when he was on the spot, when something horrible had happened on the road, bad accident, whether we were in the right or wrong, I noticed his eyes would blink a lot, and he'd, a lot. But he was thinking while he would say that. And there's one story that that sort of exemplifies that, that my dad's, I wouldn't call it stuttering, but it's like he's thinking of what to say that's going to not incriminate him or make the, you know. But they had the cavalcade of champions here, where all these former boxing champions, from Muhammad Ali down to Joe Louis, I'd say in chronology, Louis maybe being the oldest, they came here. And Ali couldn't make it for some reason, but he was supposed to come and did come to some of this cavalcade took place all across Canada and probably the States as well. But they'd show old excerpts, pretty good ones, of their boxing history. Then the boxer himself would get up and speak. So one of the first ones to speak was Jake LaMotta, and he gets up. And I don't even know how he knew my dad was there. He may have recognized my dad from New York or New Jersey when my dad was wrestling in Pertutes, but he gets up and he says, I did that about 10 times. People think, God, this guy's punchy. Then he said, I took elocution lessons from Stu Hott. And he singled my dad out and waved at him. My dad got up and waved at him. And my mother pulled my dad's coattail down. Sit down, you're embarrassing this whole table. And at the table was Ed Whalen and his wife and a few other people. I think the owner of the hotel was there too. And
it's interesting though, because you're saying, because that's the famous Stu Hart imitation,
right? Yeah.
But you're saying he was doing that because he was thinking, and not wanting to just say stuff to
it's covering up.
Hang
it's
himself.
Like, it's a ploy. As he, you know, it's like he lets you know that he's with you, but he's hearing you, and he's in the, you know, he's working this situation out, but he's, you know, he's wondering what the hell to say. He didn't want to commit himself to the wrong thing, admit that the driver was drunk or didn't have a license or is, you know, a speed demon or you know, is wanted or something. You know, he's going to be working some kind of, coming up with some compromise.
Right. How about Owen?
Owen was really good at imitating people. He had a knack. He could do anybody's voice pretty much, and or even a you know, he'd do a foreigner's voice, you know, or a East Indian voice or something. And he'd call my dad up, and he'd bait my dad with something really easy and friendly, you know. And do you remember this guy? And my dad didn't even know who he was talking to, but he'd know what they were talking about. Yes, I remember Sky Lee or Doug Hepburn or something. And then he'd want to break into the phony bastard. I could have beat him or something. Or he did it with Reg Parks. Reg was one of these guys, like, my dad enjoyed taking bodybuilders apart in the gym, kind of like making them squeak and stuff, because a lot of them are very, you know, I don't know what your experience is with bodybuilders, but a lot of them are very sort of what I would call precious and semi-detached. They're all into themselves and much else. Every time they have a bowel movement, they make note of it in their diary and maybe the temperature of it and stuff. They really that way. And but Reggie was kind of like a lifeguard type bodybuilder. He wasn't massive, like
just physical fit, good shape.
Yeah, like Steve DeSalvo or something. Mm-hmm. But he had a slim, you know. But Owen had just heard some of the stories about Reggie Parks, and he called my dad up as Reggie, saying he just met Reggie and he had the voice down pat. And he says, "Dude, I always thought I got to get something off my chest." And my dad, "What's that, Reggie?" And my dad's friendly, you know, wanting to reminisce about the good old days. And Reggie, I always thought I could have taken it. All of a sudden, my dad, what? You know, like, what do you mean? And he, well, I never really had a fair chance with you in the gym. And then, I know I could have beaten you. And all my dad said, I gave you every chance you ever needed, and you can have a chance right now if you want.
This is Owen just.
And Reggie, who's like thousands of miles away, like in Kansas City or St. Louis from Calgary, is still scared that there might be repercussions where Stu comes down to straighten him out.
So would Owen finally say, hey, Dad, it's me?
I guess so. Yeah.
Or just hang up and let him steam.
Usually Stu would finally say, that's you, Owen. You got me again, you son of a bitch.
Well, you had so many great stories and great tales and actually a lot of years in the ring too. So let me ask this as a final question. Mm-hmm. What's your favorite match that you ever had?
Well, I had my favorite matches were either with the Stomper or with Abdullah.
Working against them.
Bled like a pig for both of them. part of gimmicks to set it up for my dad to wrestle them.
Oh, okay. So you were kind of the stepping stone. They kicked the shit out of the son.
Yeah.
So now the dad has to get revenge.
That's right.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah. Great story, Smith.
Thank you, Chris.
Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks to the amazing Smith Hart. Very eccentric, but a good guy. Thanks to him for sharing all the stories about the crazy, legendary, iconic Hart family. So cool to have him on. Thanks to him. Thanks to you guys as well for listening to Talk is Jericho twice this week. And thanks for subscribing on iTunes and getting all your friends to subscribe and leave 5-star ratings and comments. And thanks for supporting all the great sponsors of Talk is Jericho, including Amazon. They've been with the show since the very first episode with Steve Austin way back when. If you want to hear it, you got to go go check out the premium side of podcast1.com. Very, very valuable service. But go back and listen. You'll see that Amazon was there, and it's the easiest way to support TIJ. You can get almost anything you can think of on Amazon. And hey, I want you to be a Talk is Jericho Amazon warrior. If you buy something on Amazon using one of my links, send me the pic of what you bought on Amazon. I will retweet it and I will follow you. That's at Talk is Jericho on the Twitter. Go do that now. Become a Jericho Amazon warrior. You can use those Talk is Jericho links to get to Amazon. And you can find them links by going to podcast1.com. Click on the Killer Deals button on the top right corner of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. You can do that in the U.S. the UK, the Canada A, and every time you use those links, Amazon kicks back a couple bucks to the show to help us cover these production costs. No extra fees or hidden charges. You're just taking it to the streets and helping out your boy. All right, and thanks to all my other great sponsors, I want you to check them out, DDP Yoga and the DDP Yoga Now app. Go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho and get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. This really works. I want you to try it. Harry's.com for the smoothest shave you can get. Use my promo code there. DraftKings.com. Use the promo code Y2J to play for free. There's Uber. There's Geico. So many people jumping on board, including you. And I thank you very much for being here. Thank you so much for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And next Wednesday, the streak of great shows continues. I don't know if you watched Raw last Monday. The debut, the long-awaited debut of Carl Anderson and the return of Luke Gallows. They are here. They came from New Japan Bullet Club all the way to the WWE. They are here to stay, and they are a pair of characters. I'll tell you what, they will be here on Wednesday. Who brings you the biggest guests? I do. All right, we'll see you on Wednesday. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a double nugs. All right, yeah, boy.
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcast1.com. That's podcastone.com.